From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the threat of anthrax and smallpox. We'll talk with Dr. Jonathan Tucker, an expert on chemical and biological weapons, and author of the new book, Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. Tucker served on the biological weapons inspection team that went to Iraq in 1995. Also, tracking the terrorist money trail. As former special advisor in the Clinton administration, William Wexler tracked money laundering by drug cartels and arms traffickers and investigated Osama bin Laden's financial network. He'll discuss the challenges in attacking the financial roots of terrorism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. In New York City, investigators are trying to determine how a hospital worker was exposed to the inhaled form of anthrax. The woman died today, becoming that city's first fatality from the disease. From New York, NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Hospital clerk Kathy Nguyen died of inhalation anthrax. Her case is particularly troubling to federal and New York health officials because they don't know how or where the 61-year-old was exposed to the bacteria. She worked in a basement supply room that until recently included a mail facility, but there is no evidence of any tainted letter, and preliminary tests of the work area and her Bronx apartment have come back negative. Investigators say they're now trying to backtrack Nguyen's movements to determine the source. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said preliminary tests show some indications of anthrax spores on her clothing. Meantime, workers and recent patients at the Eye and Ear Hospital were given antibiotics. Edwin Pierce of Harlem had a doctor's visit there last week.
You got to take precautions. You never know, you know, and then, like, it'll start messing with your head. So, you know, I came down there and got the medication and, you know, keep my sanity.
Eric Westervelt, NPR News, New York.
Officials have found traces of anthrax bacteria at a facility in Indiana where postal machines are repaired. Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon says spores were found on a piece of postal equipment sent to Indianapolis for cleaning. The machinery came from a contaminated mail processing center in Washington, D.C. According to the state's health commissioner, a private lab took 44 samples and one was positive for anthrax. Switzerland has frozen 24 bank accounts after receiving a list of individuals, companies, and organizations from the U.S. government that it says may be linked to terrorist groups. NPR's Guy Raz reports.
Finance officials in Europe refused to release details about the new list compiled by the Bush administration. At least 200 individuals and another 200 groups and companies are believed to be on the list. A source in Britain told the Reuters news agency that many of the names on the list have been transliterated from Arabic, making them difficult to track down. Shortly after the September 11 attacks, the Bush administration froze 27 bank accounts. Hundreds more have been frozen in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Earlier this month, the administration issued a list of 39 bank accounts tied to individuals and organizations it suspects of being involved with terrorist groups. Switzerland says the 24 accounts will remain frozen indefinitely. Guy Raz, NPR News, Berlin.
The Bush administration has reversed itself and now says it will accept a new, tougher standard for arsenic in drinking water. The standard was first proposed in the last days of the Clinton administration. Bush administration suspended the new rule, citing its scientific basis and the cost. But now EPA Director Christy Whitman says the new rule will help protect against the risk of cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 47, the Nasdaq up 23. You're listening to NPR News. Former Symbionese Liberation Army fugitive Sarah Jane Olson pleaded guilty today to charges in connection with an attempted bombing in 1975. The plea came in an agreement that does not guarantee Olson a specific sentence. Her lawyers say they expect her to get about 5 years in prison, but the judge warned she could be sentenced to life behind bars. Spanish police have arrested 13 leaders of a prisoner support group for ETA Basque separatists. It is the latest action in a crackdown on the armed organizations and its political sympathizers. Elizabeth Nash has the latest from Madrid.
The leaders were rounded up before dawn throughout Spain's northeastern Basque region and neighboring Navarra and brought to Madrid for questioning. They're accused of belonging to or cooperating with a terrorist organization. The so-called amnesty committees support ETA prisoners and their families, but police say they have financial links to terrorists even though they're not directly involved in armed actions. As part of the police action, 22 bank accounts were frozen. Some had received funds from the regional Basque government. Madrid says the committees organized ETA prisoners, gave them money, and passed on ETA instructions for street fighting. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Nash in Madrid.
About $200 million worth of gold and silver is being removed from beneath the World Trade Center rubble. The metals were stashed in a Bank of Nova Scotia vault. The vault was not in the main towers, the twin towers, but it was in a building that was reduced to mostly rubble when the towers went down. The eight employees who were guarding the vault when the attacks took place escaped unharmed. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William Bingham Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer and City Hall reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in today for Terry Gross. As cases of anthrax contamination continue to appear in the United States, citizens and policymakers have begun to consider the possibility of a terrorist attack using an even more lethal chemical or biological agent, such as smallpox or plague bacteria. Jonathan Tucker has spent years researching and writing about the threat of biological and chemical warfare. Tucker was a member of the United Nations inspection team in Iraq searching for weapons of mass destruction. He's currently at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Washington, where he and his colleagues recently assembled data on more than 500 incidents of biological and chemical attacks across the world. His new book, Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox, deals with the grim history of smallpox epidemics, the successful effort to eradicate the disease, and the unsettling prospect of terrorists using the deadly virus as a weapon. I asked Jonathan Tucker what we've learned about smallpox from earlier epidemics.
Well, the smallpox virus, unlike anthrax, is contagious from person to person, and particularly in a population that is genetically vulnerable, that has not been exposed to the virus before over the generations, as was the case with the Indians of North and South America. The disease can spread like wildfire through such a population and cause very high levels of mortality. And such an epidemic is a so-called virgin soil epidemic because the population has been sheltered from exposure to the organism, and when it encounters it for the first time, there is a very dramatic epidemic. In countries such as Europe, which experienced smallpox over a period of centuries, it gradually became primarily a disease of children because people were almost universally exposed to the disease and either died as children or survived the disease and grew to adulthood with permanent immunity.
You make the point that in countries where smallpox remained, that the epidemics were less devastating over time because those with the most resistance survived and the population became genetically stronger against the disease. In the United States, we've now been without smallpox for at least a couple of generations, and we've no longer been vaccinating since, I guess, what, the 70s or 80s. Does that mean that the United States are a more vulnerable population to a smallpox outbreak today?
Well, the genetic resistance is something that evolves over centuries, if not millennia, so that is a much slower process. But we are definitely immunologically vulnerable to this disease. There's a debate over how long the protection was produced by vaccination. The rule of thumb is about 10 years, although some people believe it was considerably longer. But the majority of our population either was vaccinated once in childhood or people born since 1972 in this country were not vaccinated at all as children. So a substantial portion of our population is susceptible to the disease.
And the vaccine itself, of course, has some risky side effects. What about folks who are immunocompromised, such as people who have the HIV virus?
Well, people who are immunocompromised would be extremely susceptible to infection in the first place, but they would also be vulnerable to complications from the vaccine. The vaccine is derived not from the smallpox virus itself, but from a related but normally benign virus known as vaccinia, The original vaccine virus was cowpox. That was Edward Jenner's great discovery in the late 18th century, that a normally benign infection called cowpox, which primarily infected milkmaids, could protect them against a much more lethal disease, smallpox. And at some point over the centuries, vaccinia, another virus, began to be used in the place of cowpox as the vaccine virus. Normally, vaccinia is harmless in someone who is healthy, has a robust immune system. But in someone whose immune system is compromised, the vaccine virus can actually replicate out of control and cause very severe complications, such as what's called vaccinal encephalitis, an inflammation of the brain that can be fatal or cause permanent brain damage. So the vaccine should not be given lightly. There's been some debate over whether the entire population should be vaccinated against the off chance that smallpox might be introduced by terrorists. I think that would be an unwise decision. And there are some characteristics of this vaccine that make it possible to deliver it in a more targeted way.
My guest is biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. You note the irony that it was the Soviet Union which championed the cause of the eradication of smallpox in the 30s and 40s, but then later developed a massive and secret biological weapons program. Just how extensive was that effort?
It was a terrible irony. On the one hand, the Soviets were the driving force behind the global eradication program, which the United States, at least initially, was quite reluctant to support. We favored investing resources in eradicating malaria, and we saw the campaign to eradicate smallpox as a kind of competition to that effort. And there was, at least for a while, this public health campaign fell victim to Cold War tensions. But at some point in the late 60s, when the malaria campaign was faltering, the United States decided to support the Soviet call for a global campaign and intensify a global effort to eradicate smallpox. And there were a number of leading Soviet epidemiologists and virologists who played a very key role in the eradication campaign, and the Soviet Union contributed 25 million doses of smallpox vaccine a year. So on the one hand, the Soviet Union played an indispensable role in the eradication campaign. At the same time, the Soviet military was secretly developing smallpox virus as a weapon. It was clearly different people involved. The public health doctors were, I believe, truly dedicated to the noble goal of eradicating this horrible disease, and they were betrayed as much as the rest of the world by the efforts of the Soviet military to turn smallpox into a weapon.
Of course, the Soviet biological weapons program was going strong when the collapse of communism occurred, but did the destruction of so much of the Soviet infrastructure at the time leave the smallpox samples in those weapons programs vulnerable to theft or sale on the black market?
Well, that is definitely a concern. The Soviet biological weapons program was really remarkable and appalling in scale and scope. It involved roughly 60,000 people at upwards of 50 to 100 facilities scattered across the Soviet Union, not only in Russia, but in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and other republics. And a whole variety of biological warfare agents were produced. Not only smallpox, but also anthrax and plague were manufactured in large quantities and stockpiled for planned use in World War III. There were ballistic missiles and strategic bombers that would have delivered these weapons against American cities, probably in conjunction with a nuclear war as a way of killing the survivors of a nuclear exchange. So it was really a doomsday scenario that the Soviets had developed.
Is there suspicion that Russia was maintaining offensive biological weapons research even after the collapse of communism?
There is actually lingering concern to this day about four military biological facilities. The Russians claim that they are engaged in defensive research. But these four military microbiology facilities under the auspices of the Russian Ministry of Defense remain top secret, shrouded in secrecy, and are arousing considerable suspicion in the West. So I think if the Russians want to come clean about what they did in the past and to reassure us that they are engaged strictly in defensive and legitimate activities, they should open up these four facilities to visits or inspections and reassure the world that they have ended their past behavior.
My guest is biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. He is the author of Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. Smallpox as an illness has been eradicated from the earth, but samples of the virus remain in the custody of the United States and Russia. And your book documents a debate which has raged through the 90s about whether these remaining stocks of the smallpox virus should be destroyed. What's the argument for keeping them alive?
There are a number of arguments. Initially, virologists and other scientists were interested in studying smallpox virus because it was a uniquely human disease. The virus only infects human beings, does not have an animal reservoir, and hence it was exquisitely adapted to the human immune system. The virus actually had evolved a number of countermeasures to deceive the human immune system by, for example, sending out decoy proteins that would interfere with the human immune response and enable the virus to replicate out of control and cause disease. So virologists became quite fascinated with studying the mechanisms of the virus, determining its DNA sequence, how it worked as a kind of molecular machine. And that was the initial impetus behind the pressure from the scientific community to delay destruction of the virus. They saw it as a valuable scientific resource. More recently, with the growing concern about the possibility that undeclared stocks of the smallpox virus may exist outside the two official repositories, there has been a growing pressure from government officials to employ the existing stocks of smallpox virus to develop better defenses. For example, to screen antiviral drugs for activity against smallpox, because at the moment, even though we have an effective vaccine, there is no good treatment for smallpox.
What's the likelihood that a rogue state or a terrorist group possesses a sample of the smallpox virus?
It's very difficult to quantify the probabilities. The evidence, at least in the public domain, is all circumstantial. But it does implicate at least three states. Russia is believed to have undeclared stocks outside of its official repository. Iraq has been alleged to retain the virus, as has North Korea. And a number of other countries are named as suspects. So the evidence, for example, is that states such as Iraq and North Korea have continued to vaccinate their troops against the disease. But, of course, other countries have as well. The United States was routinely vaccinating military recruits until 1990, and we only stopped because of some concerns about the antidote used to treat complications of the vaccine. Other types of evidence include the fact that Iraq has admitted that it experimented with the camelpox virus before the Gulf War. Camelpox is the closest relative of smallpox among the pox viruses that infect animals. And this is somewhat suspicious because camelpox does not normally cause disease in humans, or if it does, it causes a very mild infection. So the question was, why was the Iraqi Biological Weapons Program working with this particular virus? Some people believe that the Iraqis actually had specimens of smallpox virus which were too dangerous to work with directly. So they were instead working with camelpox as a surrogate or model for the development of production and delivery techniques, which could then be readily applied to smallpox.
If a terrorist group were to acquire smallpox from a rogue state, what challenges would they face in turning it into a weapon? How easy is that to do?
Well, the first step, acquiring it from a rogue state, is not necessarily that straightforward. I mean, the state would have to decide that it was in its interest to provide this very dangerous virus to a terrorist group that might easily evade its control. Now, one thing about smallpox, because it is contagious, it's not an easily targetable weapon. If the disease is not contained, it can easily spread from country to country and might well come back to haunt the very people that released it, or at least the people on behalf they claim to be acting. So that is obviously a concern on the motivational side. Why would someone want to release what is really a doomsday weapon? But assuming that they are motivated, and of course terrorists have done irrational things in the past, there would be a number of hurdles. First, they would have to grow the virus. It's much more difficult to grow a viral agent than a bacterial agent such as anthrax. A bacterial agent will simply grow in a nutrient medium, whereas a viral agent will only grow inside living cells. And living cells are much more difficult to grow, much more finicky, require very special culture conditions and nutrients. So it would be quite challenging for a terrorist organization to produce large quantities of the smallpox virus. Then they would have to develop some means of disseminating the virus through the air, which is its natural route of delivery. Some people have talked about the possibility of a very low-tech means of delivery, which would be that terrorists would, if they had suicidal inclinations, would simply infect themselves with the disease and then circulate among the target population, spreading the disease that way. That is possible, though it's not the most efficient way of spreading the disease. But there are a number of constraints. For one thing, the window of opportunity when people would become contagious but not easily detectable would be quite narrow. That is, people with smallpox only become contagious with the first appearance of the rash, which initially resembles chickenpox, red spots on the skin that gradually swell with fluid and then with pus. But by the time the characteristic smallpox rash has appeared, it would be impossible to conceal even with makeup and would be a dead giveaway. Also, the early phase of the disease is accompanied by severe prostration, back pain, high fever, exhaustion. It would be very difficult for people to wander around spreading the disease. And finally, even someone who was willing to die instantly in a blaze of glory and in an explosion might think twice about a slow, painful, and hideous death from smallpox. So one would have to be an extreme fanatic to be willing to engage in that kind of attack.
You've looked at efforts to fight biological terrorism. How long will it take before the United States has enough smallpox vaccine to defend itself against an attack?
Well, the Bush administration has been moving very rapidly to increase the available supply. The first step they're doing is to take the stocks left over from the global eradication campaign, which numbers somewhere between 7.5 million and 15 million doses, and see if they can be diluted either fivefold or tenfold. Probably fivefold is more realistic. But that would substantially increase the number of doses as a stopgap until more vaccine can be produced. At the same time, the Health and Human Services Department has issued contracts initially for 54 million doses to a company called Acambus. And now Secretary Thompson has announced that he wants to acquire beyond that, an additional 250 million doses by the end of next year. So if that actually materializes, which I think will be challenging but perhaps feasible, by the end of next year or early 2003, we should have enough vaccine for every man, woman, and child in the country. Now, it's important to stress that if there were a reasonably small or medium-sized outbreak, we would not need to vaccinate the entire country. The vaccine would be delivered in a more targeted way so that anyone who was either exposed or potentially exposed to someone with the contagious phase of the disease would be vaccinated. And it, in the manner of creating a fire break to break the chain of human-to-human transmission and snuff out the flame of infection before it could spread further. And this is the strategy, this targeted strategy, was used very successfully in the eradication campaign of the 1960s and 70s. But if the disease was not recognized, if the outbreak was not recognized at an early enough stage and had spread substantially, for example, to multiple states, at that point, it might be necessary to vaccinate the entire country. So I think that is the rationale for having enough vaccine on the shelf for every citizen, even though I don't think it makes sense to vaccinate prophylactically.
You and your colleagues at the Monterey Institute of International Studies compiled a database of more than 500 incidents of chemical and biological attacks, and in writing about this research, I guess some months ago, you suggested that public officials and certainly the media had exaggerated the threat of a biological terrorist attack. Given the recent discoveries of anthrax, do you feel differently today?
Well, one of our main conclusions was that very few terrorist organizations were motivated to inflict indiscriminate casualties, and of those, very few of that subset had the capability to carry out a large-scale biological attack. And I think we would still stick by that assessment. We were looking at both the motivational side and the capability side of the equation, and drawing from the historical record, we found that the likelihood of a large-scale biological attack by terrorists was quite small, not zero, but small. Of course, there is always some risk in trying to extrapolate from history into the future. There could be historical discontinuities, and I think we have seen some aspects of the current events that we could not have predicted from the past.
Well, Jonathan Tucker, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Tucker is director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. His new book is Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, tracking the finances of terrorism. We'll talk with William Wexler about the challenges of investigating the financial movements of terrorists, drug traffickers, and illegal arms dealers. Wexler was a special advisor in the Clinton administration, where he was part of the effort to track Osama bin Laden's financial network. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Soon after the September 11th attacks, President Bush announced he would freeze the assets of suspected terrorists and their confederates and promised to get tough with foreign banks and governments that shield their operations. William Wexler has spent years tracking the shadowy financial transactions and money laundering of drug dealers, criminal syndicates, and international terrorists. In the Clinton administration, he was director for transnational threats at the National Security Council, where he directed the U.S. investigation of Osama bin Laden's financial network, and he was special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury. Congress recently approved new financial regulations as part of an anti-terrorism package, which was signed by President Bush. I asked Wexler why new controls are needed.
What needs to happen is that the U.S. government, the Treasury Department in particular now, needs to provide explicit guidance to the U.S. financial industry, looking at all the case studies that we have, that we know of terrorist money raising and money movement in the United States and around the world, and finding the specific patterns that are applicable to terrorist financing, and giving that information to the U.S. financial industry so they know what to look for, so that they know when to issue a what's called a suspicious activity report to the federal government, something that might help spur a law enforcement case.
What are some of the suspicious patterns of terrorist financing?
Some of them involve where the money comes from, and some of them involve how the money is used. Some of the money comes from banks in specific regions around the world that deserve a higher level of scrutiny than banks in other regions around the world. Some of it comes through the underground hawala banking system, which has been used for centuries by Middle Eastern people. Some of it comes from the Islamic banking system. Some of it comes in wires from abroad of a large amount, which then over a period of time is cut up into much smaller pieces and moved into different accounts. Some of it is raised through charitable organizations, even perhaps in the United States, through the guise of giving to, say, orphans and widows in the fight against Chechnya, but actually then goes for terrorist organizations. And then some of it comes from standard criminal frauds, smuggling, things that you should be on the lookout for anyway.
I'd like you to explain the hawala system, this low-tech system of international money transfers, which some believe has been used extensively by terrorists.
The first thing to understand about the hawala system is that there is absolutely nothing inherently illegitimate about it. If the world history had gone a different way, the hawala system would have evolved into the banking system that we use instead of the banking system that was created by the Medicis in Italy. The hawala system was created centuries ago, mostly to support Arab traders on their way back and forth through the subcontinent. It's run by South Asians, Indians and Pakistanis, who have basically been doing this work for generations and generations. In fact, hawala, depending on who you listen to, comes from an Arabic word meaning change and also a Hindi word meaning trust. And that basically encaptures the main elements of the hawala system. It's a system of money transfer without money movement. The money goes from one place to another, but there is no movement of money between those two points.
How does it work?
Give you a quick example. Say you are in the United States and you want to move money back to your mother in Pakistan in a very rural part. You could just go to your account, your bank, say Citibank, and try to wire the money to your mother's account, or you could try to send a check. But the problem with that might be that there might not be any Citibank branch where your mother lives, and it might be very difficult to get that check in, and there might be onerous government provisions that make it difficult for your mother to get the money. Or you could just go down to your neighborhood hawaladar, probably in the back of a store, and give that person the amount of money that you want to send in cash, say $1,000, give that person a little fee. What the hawaladar then does is picks up the phone or sends an email or sends a fax to his colleague in Pakistan, and that colleague takes the same amount of money, takes the $1,000 out of his store of cash and simply just gives it to your mother. The money has been transferred from you to your mother, but no money has moved. No money has moved physically. No money has moved through any wire transfer or the established above-ground banking system.
And is it a practice that the records are then destroyed at both ends?
Quite often the records are destroyed. Quite often, sometimes there are very limited records in the first place. This system operates on trust. It operates because one Hawaladar in New York and another Hawaladar in Pakistan trust each other. They most likely are related somewhere way back in the generations. They know that neither one of them is going to cheat the other one, that they're both good for the money. They're good for clearing the books. Records don't have to be kept with the same level of specificity that we would imagine in the West.
So it's an easy, non-traceable way of delivering a few thousand dollars for buying weapons or flying lessons, for example. How do you get a hold of that?
Well, you're absolutely right. The system itself is not illegitimate, but it provides a lot of advantages that any terrorist would want. It provides no records. It provides a degree of secrecy. It is a well-established network that operates literally all around the world. And the sad fact is that the ethnic populations that have operated the Hawala system for a long time are very convenient for the Al-Qaeda network. It's, again, run by South Asians for the Middle East, Middle Eastern people and Arabs, and it has for centuries and centuries. How you deal with it is you bring the system out from underground, above ground. How you deal with it is by, in the United States, for instance, passing a regulation that would require these Hawaladars to register as formal official businesses that would then be required to abide by the same requirements that all financial institutions abide by. If you try to make it illegal, then you'll just drive it further underground. But if you try to bring it out from underground and bring it into the regular financial system, then I think you'll have some success over time.
So how do the new banking regulations enacted by Congress affect Hawalas?
What Congress did is Congress formally required the Treasury Department to pass a kind of to write and issue this kind of regulation. Actually, one of the sad things is right near the end of the Clinton administration, we did issue this kind of regulation that would require all Hawaladars to register. It was going to come into effect at the end of this year because it takes some time to communicate to all the Hawaladars their new requirements. The Bush administration, as one of their first decisions, postponed this regulation again. In the wake of September 11th, however, and certainly in the wake of this action by the U.S. Congress, I believe that they've reconsidered this decision and will now bring this regulation into force at the end of the year.
My guest is William Wexler, who investigated terrorists' financial networks during the Clinton administration. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Wexler. He headed the Clinton administration's efforts to investigate Osama bin Laden's financial network. President Bush recently signed a new anti-terrorism bill enacted by Congress, which included some financial and banking provisions. How will they help?
They will go a long way to helping us in the fight against Al-Qaeda's financial network and money laundering writ large. They do two fundamental things. First, at home, they strengthen our own domestic anti-money laundering regime. There are several loopholes in our current situation, the most glaring of which is that the anti-money laundering laws mainly apply to banks and depository institutions and don't apply to non-depository financial institutions, talking about stockbrokers, talking about the wire transmitters, talking about insurance companies, casinos, all of these kinds of entities which perform many of the same functions of banks for people who might want to launder money. And now they will be brought into the U.S. anti-money laundering regime. The second thing that the new law does is it gives the Secretary of the Treasury a whole set of new authorities by which he can, in a graduated, targeted fashion, take action against what's called primary money laundering concerns. A foreign country, a foreign bank, a foreign type of transaction that is identified as particularly helping a criminal or terrorist network move dirty money. At the highest end, what this would mean is that the Secretary of the Treasury would be able to block U.S. financial institutions, U.S. banks, from being allowed to have correspondent relationships with foreign banks that he designates as playing a significant role in laundering, say, Al-Qaeda's money.
When you testified before Congress, I believe last year, you made the point that it is very easy for even a small nation to become a money laundering center. What did you mean?
Well, the world has changed, and the world has changed because of globalization, because of advances in banking and communications technology, because of the Internet. In the old days, when you look back at your James Bond or Jean Le Carré novels, you heard about Switzerland and the Cayman Islands being famous places for people to go to receive no-questions-asked banking secrecy. And they definitely were, and they became very, very wealthy because of it. What they had in common was physical proximity to major money centers. That, provided with their strict bank secrecy laws, gave them an edge up against all the competition in this regard. It was an easy thing to do for a banker, say, in London to travel to Zurich with a suitcase full of cash, or for that matter, a banker in New York or Miami to go to the Cayman Islands. But in recent years, physical proximity doesn't matter. The Internet exists. You can be anywhere in the world and set up a website and suddenly find that you can have customers everywhere else in the world. It didn't take long for a number of countries to figure this out, and places that many people might not have heard of in, say, the South Pacific, places like Nauru and Vanuatu and Niue, places in the Caribbean that are a little more difficult to get to, places like Dominica and Grenada, places in the middle of Europe like Liechtenstein, all these places changed their laws, made it harder for foreign law enforcement to track the money back there. In fact, they explicitly created laws that disallowed customer identification, that prevented foreign law enforcement, from gaining any information, that established very, very strict bank secrecy. Then they put up internet sites, and they blatantly advertised. They said, put your money in our bank, and the FBI can't get you. This was all out in the open, and it was a marked change in the world environment that allowed lots of money to move in ways that the U.S. government, international institutions, other legitimate authorities could not see.
Some of these are Pacific Island nations with small populations where their bank deposits amount to literally tens of millions per resident. Given that they're so invested in that kind of illicit banking relationships, what pressure could the United States exert which would change their behavior?
Well, I'll tell you what we did do at the end of the Clinton administration. We decided a couple of things. First of all, that in order to end this problem, in order to really address it successfully, you needed a multilateral approach. Secondly, that the approach had to harness market forces in order for it to be really effective. And so what we did was the United States Secretary of the Treasury, Larry Summers, led the fight. The United States went with its allies in the G7 nations and broader through an organization called the Financial Action Task Force. And these 29 nations looked at a whole bunch of countries around the world, a lot of these small countries, but a lot of larger countries as well, and really thoroughly examined their laws and regulations that made up their anti-money laundering regime. The result of it was a naming and shaming process that named the countries that were deemed non-cooperative in the global fight against money laundering. These countries included a lot of these small island nations, but also included countries like Israel and Russia and Panama and Philippines. There were no favorites were played, no favors were given. This coincided intentionally with a couple of other sister projects. One through the OECD, which did the same thing towards tax havens around the world, and another through an organization called the Financial Stability Forum, which did the same thing on offshore jurisdictions that whose lax supervision contributed to potentially to macroeconomic instability. These three naming and shaming processes all ended all completed their work, all named and shamed the countries before the G7 meeting last year. It was an amazing effect. What you saw immediately were banks around the world in major money centers cutting off their correspondent relations with banks in the countries that were named. You saw the countries that were named having difficulties getting bond issuances at the same rates as they were before. You saw Standard & Poor's lower their own ratings on banks in, say, Liechtenstein. And you saw a real diplomatic, political reaction where country after country on these lists immediately took strong actions to change their entire laws, their entire regulations, and really come up to international standards. Many of these countries have been refusing to do this for years and years, and suddenly they found the political will. That's how you do it. You do it through a multilateral effort that harnesses market forces, that really drives home the point where it matters in the wallet.
Pressuring international banks that may conduct illicit operations is one thing, but there's also the issue of United States banks which have correspondent relationships with banks in countries where regulations are lax. What exactly are these relationships and how do they benefit U.S. banks?
Correspondent relationship is a very wide term, and what it basically means are the way one bank talks to another bank. If you are doing a transaction between your bank and another bank, and this could mean any credit card transaction, any financial transaction that you do every day, one bank has to talk to another bank to know how to get money out of your account or put money into your account. That, at the fundamental basis, is what correspondent relationships are all about. A large bank, a Citibank or a Chase, will have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, of correspondent relationships around the world with foreign banks. And if the United States government was to shut off those entry points, it would be devastating to those foreign banks. So it gives the United States a large amount of leverage by which we can go out to the world and try to make sure that these foreign banks are not aiding and abetting, say, the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, whether willingly or totally unwittingly.
So the new rules would require banks to know exactly who they're dealing with?
Banks are already required to know their customer is the term. There have been a lot of instances where, after the fact, the U.S. government has thought that individual banks in the United States have done a very poor job of knowing their customer. Very famously, Citibank's private banking unit, for instance, provided services to Raul Salinas, the brother of the president of Mexico, when he was involved in drug dealing and had millions and millions of his dollars in his accounts. And there are a number of other examples like this. What the new legislation would do would, in a general case, make sure, require a higher level of due diligence from these banks about who they do business with and who their correspondent banks do business with, and on a more targeted basis, raise the bar even higher when the U.S. government has reason to believe that an individual foreign bank is a real problem out there.
The banking industry isn't fond of this. Last year, Texas Senator Phil Graham effectively blocked measures which would have tightened these rules, and they unsuccessfully, I believe, tried to get Congress to separate the banking provisions from the recent anti-terrorism bill, right?
Yes, they did, and that was really unfortunate. What was fortunate was, in the end, thanks to pressure from Senator Daschle, the Democratic leader of the Senate, and Senator Sarbanes, the Democratic head of the Banking Committee in the Senate, that the House Republicans were forced to include it in the overall terrorism package, and Senator Graham was forced to go along. Senator Graham did get several technical changes, which were quite acceptable. And in the wake, the main point is, in the wake of September 11th, the arguments that were made last year, that Senator Graham made last year, that prevented this anti-money laundering law from even getting a vote in a committee, even getting a hearing in the first place, these arguments were thrown out the window. And there was a widespread recognition that you really needed to do something about the flows of dirty money around the world if you wanted to prevent the kind of actions, horrible terrorist actions, that we saw on September 11th.
My guest is William Wexler, who investigated terrorist financial networks during the Clinton administration. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, back with our guest William Wexler, who spent years tracking the financial dealings of drug syndicates and international terrorists. What are some successes that one might point to in the effort to track the financial dealings of terrorists?
Most of the successes are, by their very nature, secret. The quid pro quo is the assistance is given to the United States, and what the other country gets is that this assistance is secret. So I can't speak of many of them. But one that I can't speak of involves Ariana Airlines, the national airline of Afghanistan. The United States government, after a lot of work, came to the conclusion that Ariana Airlines was being used to ferry money, personnel, and materiel for al-Qaeda in and out of Afghanistan and then to places where it could go around the world. We had designated the Taliban already as deserving of U.S. sanctions. And it wasn't too hard to figure out that that Ariana Airlines, as the national airline of Afghanistan, was owned or controlled by the Taliban. We saw who was running the organization, and it was a Taliban-run organization. So we designated Ariana Airlines. Immediately, the question was how much money is blocked, and the answer to that was not too much. And people said, well, this doesn't really matter because Ariana Airlines doesn't land in the United States, so who cares if the U.S. has put sanctions on it? But that thought missed the point. The point was is then you could go quietly to other governments around the world who had allowed Ariana landing rights in the United States and had regular, in many cases, daily flights from Ariana Airlines. And you could then say to them, your airports would hate to be put in a position of having to choose between having Ariana land there and having, say, American or United Airlines landing there. And quietly behind the scenes, many countries came to the obvious decision and decided to block Ariana from having any more landing rights on their in their airports. This was later internationalized overtly through a UN Security Council resolution on which the U.S. and Russia worked very closely. That's the kind of process by which a important node in the network raises and moves money and material for al-Qaeda can be disrupted, at least for a time. And disruption is again the goal here. It's a valuable thing to do. When elements are disrupted, that means it takes al-Qaeda time and personnel and money and effort to recreate it. And while they're doing that and while they're spending that time and money and effort, they're not spending that time and money and effort blowing something up.
Shutting down Afghanistan's national airline certainly must have had effects beyond its ability to transfer money for al-Qaeda. I mean, it's a struggling economy. Does that seem like a bit of a blunt instrument to try and get at financial transactions?
It wasn't, because it was a targeted effort made once it was determined that Ariana Airlines was being used for this purpose. These weren't sanctions that were done willy-nilly against all elements of the Afghan economy. These were done against particular entities that were being used in this fashion. And that's the way to do sanctions. That's the way to do sanctions effectively. And that's the way to have an effect on the terrorist network writ large.
How much effect do we think that this kind of activity will have on terrorists? Can we shut them down with this kind of work?
You will not wake up tomorrow and read in a newspaper headline that we have frozen all of Osama bin Laden's money and therefore al-Qaeda is no more. That's simply not how it works. But over the long run, following the money, attacking the financial network is an essential part of the overall coordinated efforts to take down the terrorist organization. Look at, say, our efforts against organized crime here in the United States. It was a long time ago that we put Al Capone in jail for tax evasion. And ever since then, we've been going after the financial network that supports organized crime in the United States as part of our coordinated law enforcement efforts against organized crime. Organized crime still exists. The financial network that supports organized crime still exists in the United States. So even after this many decades, you haven't scored a knockout blow against organized crime. Now, that said, organized crime today is nowhere near what it was 30 or 40 years ago. It's a mere shadow of the influence and power and money that it had back then. That success, over the long term, that success without a ticker tape parade, without a clear moment of victory, but that is exactly the kind of success that we need to envision as we go after the Al-Qaeda financial network.
William Wexler, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
William Wexler investigated the financial dealings of terrorists and drug traffickers as a special advisor during the Clinton administration. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, Naomi Person, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Yankees versus the Diamondbacks. We'll discuss the World Series and the state of baseball with Emmy Award-winning broadcaster Bob Costas. He's also the author of Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.